Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey, Faraday.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you so much, Audrey. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I am your host, Keith Haley, and Audrey, want to thank you for getting us hooked up tonight. We have broken browser record tonight. I think we have six actually open, and we're trying to do it all on one computer. I probably shouldn't have done that, but I think it'll work. Things have settled down a little bit, and I think it'll work. So here we go. Johnny Cash, we want to thank you for taking us on that trip across the United States to see 90 cities and states throughout the U.S. And Johnny Cash does a wonderful job on that number and lots of others. We ought to have a Johnny Cash night. What do you think, Mike? That'd be a good night. He's got enough songs about prison. Some of them we know are popular. And he has some others, too. And maybe we could add that and do a prison show night. You know, Johnny Paycheck used to be in my aquarium when I was in state government. I could look across the street, and he was in the prison across the street, right across from my office. And Johnny just shot a guy once. He didn't mean to do anything, but interesting singer, too. He had some great numbers beyond Take This Job and Shove It. Emily and Mike, thank you very much tonight for getting. There's lots of news, and we have a little couple of news surprises tonight, but we'll get to that a little bit later. What we try to do on this show is discuss news issues, events, and developments in this difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. Tonight is both serious and humorous, and it's our third show in a series, I believe, on the idea of private security and homeland security and government and private agencies. We've been talking a lot about the Top Secret America report, put out by Dana Priest and the Washington Post. If you haven't read that yet, ladies and gentlemen, please go to topsecretamerica.com. They put it on its own website and read that three-part series. But tonight we're going to deal with the issue of the private sector's role in homeland security. And I am proposing tonight, you'll see after a couple of news stories, and of course if you read Top Secret America, I'm proposing that Google change its name. By the way, Google just started something yesterday, and if you realize that, you can now use Google like Skype, but it's not Skype, it's Google, and you can use have a Google account, have a chat account, and you can dial phone numbers and call anywhere in the United States and talk to people on a phone absolutely free, and you can do it from your computer. I assume maybe you can do it from your Android phone, too? Sure, the same thing. I'll try it. But Google, I'm proposing that they change their name to Goggle because of all the different kind of watch procedures that they're involved in now and contracts with the United States government. But we dedicate this show to these tireless court corrections and juvenile justice profession. I talked to a very interesting corrections official this week about some things going on in Ohio that just astounded me in terms of what prisoners have access to in terms of benefits and privileges. I'm just going to say one and not even name. You know, our prisoners now at one location in the state can actually play golf. Yes, they can play miniature golf. I think that is so sweet. I mean, what a great idea. What a therapeutic process to have prisoners with golf clubs in their hands. Anyway, what we try to do in this show is look inside the practice of criminal justice and take a close-up look at this profession. Tonight we're going to look at those people that contract with the government and provide this vital and perhaps overly done quantum of Homeland Security information. You're listening on the Blog Talk Radio Network. I did a little search on my iPad for a show, and I saw something like 35,000 whatever. So that's how many shows are now recorded on Blog Talk Radio Network. And Alan Levy, he's approaching his fourth anniversary, as we are. In fact, he may have already reached it, something like today, because I believe it was August when he started 4 years ago. We started in November, shortly after he got going. But he's the genius behind the medium, and this is the place where you can have a radio show, your interest group, your political group, your astronomy group, your cigar collectors group, your trash collectors, whatever it is, you can have a radio show and broadcast and streaming audio live throughout the world to an unlimited number of listeners. And these shows are archived almost immediately, and you can use them, download them. There are no copyright use on them, so you can do what you want. So get your own show. I'm fond of saying that each night. Now, tonight our subject is going to be the role of the private sector in Homeland Security. We're going to listen to three experts talk about critical infrastructure protection. Well, I can hardly say it. And you'll hear them stumble over the word, I think, maybe a couple of times themselves, critical infrastructure protection. I always wonder what critical infrastructure protection was. Mike, have you got it down yet? Mike can't say it yet. I've been practicing critical infrastructure protection. They never define infrastructure. I guess we could go to a dictionary or on, you know, the tube or something, or the net, and see what infrastructure is, but it seems like it's like everything, isn't it? You can listen on the computer, some of you are doing. You can call in by phone. You can listen on the phone. If you decide to call during the news show, we've got some crazy news stories. Pretty tight schedule tonight. 347-996-5983, 347-996-5983. We can hold five callers at a time. And we're planning a little event where we're going to do that, actually. It's kind of going to be like a faculty wrap here coming up pretty soon about some four or five critical issues in the justice field. Well, Audrey has a blonde joke for tonight, and you have picked this out tonight as what? The best of 100? The best of 100 blonde joke, and I really like this one. Audrey, so go ahead and do it. Now, if someone should be a first-time listener, I want to point out that Audrey is a blonde. She's born in London, England, and she has been collecting blonde jokes since a small child. She is not offended by blonde jokes. So here we go, Audrey. Go ahead. What's your blonde joke for tonight? I like this one.
Professor Haley, tonight's blonde joke has to do with a blonde who may have more to learn about physics. I hope our listeners enjoy it. Here it is. A blonde was shopping at Kmart and came across a shiny silver thermos. She was quite fascinated by it, so she picked it up and took it over to the clerk to ask what it was. The clerk said, "Why, that's a thermos. It keeps hot things hot and cold things cold." "Wow," said the blonde, "that's amazing. I'm going to buy it." So she took the thermos and took it to work the next day. Her boss, who is also blonde, saw it on her desk. "What is that?" he asked. "Why, that's a thermos. It keeps hot things hot and cold things cold." She replied, "What do you have in it?" the boss asked. "Two popsicles and some coffee."
All right, she may be surprised when she starts to pour the coffee or eat the popsicle. Well, ladies and gentlemen, on a much more serious note, We've tried to do our part in reducing gun violence on the show for nearly 4 years, and the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms has a public service announcement that they would like you to hear, and this is directed toward not you, as law-abiding citizens who listen to the show, but I imagine a very small percentage of criminals probably listen to the show, but it's directed toward those criminals, so they hear this message and they go down and turn in their firearms and in turn reduce the amount of gun violence on the streets of America. So go ahead, Ohio Coalition, with your very fine public service announcement.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. Message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, thank you very much, Ohio Coalition, and we're very proud to be able to offer that message every week, 52 weeks a year for nearly four years. And then I wonder what part we've played in actually reducing gun violence in the state of Ohio and perhaps other places. Well, we have a green tip, as we have, the global warming. You have to be careful. Don't get caught up in these little quirks on the temperature, like it was a little cool this morning, and I suppose it's going to be a little cool here in Ohio again, but you got to remember that the planet is melting right before our eyes. So here's one from Esma Floyd's 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet. We've been using her book. We're not anything near covering her 1001 tips, but here's one she's saying yourself. Number 837, she's saying to you, walk yourself to an old age. Every mile you walk is estimated to add 20 minutes to your life. Mike, you can't leave yet. He's getting up to take a walk. Sit down. The show's not over. Every mile you walk is estimated to add 20 minutes to your life. Walking is also the greenest transportation method, as every single journey in your car, taxi, bus, or train contributes to air pollution. Now, I don't know what the increased body temperature does to global warming. We'll have to check the physics on that. But, some of the best fit and shapely people I know are avid daily walkers. So there you are. Walking is a great thing. And you have some goals set out if you're going to be a competitive walker. You got to top people like Ed Payson Weston, who walked across the United States 9 times. And he walked 627 miles in 6 days. But you don't have to do that. Just enjoy your walk. Carry a stick, though. You get yourself a nice walking stick, one that used to cost $70, $80. Now you can get them for $9 or $10, $11 made in China. And then if you have a wild dog or something come at you, you'll be protected. You'll have something to protect yourself with. So there you are. Walk yourself to an old age. We'll have to compute the math on that. Every mile, you add 20 minutes to your life. Mike's getting out his calculator, deciding how long he wants to live, and he's going to see how far he has to walk. That's all right, Mike. That's good. Well, let's go to some of the criminal justice news. We've certainly got some good stories tonight before we get to our feature segment. And let's take a look at some of these things going on. Some of them are almost unbelievable. This is kind of an interesting thing. In Columbus, Ohio, this week, I bet you can't imagine what happened. Columbus police do have a helicopter unit. I've seen the helicopter unit at work, actually, in Columbus on one particular occasion. And one of the officers who's on that unit, supervisor, was actually one of my graduate students a number of years back. But a camera mounted to a police helicopter in Columbus, Ohio, fell off in mid-flight, striking at least 3 vehicles in a parking lot. Fortunately, nobody on the ground was hurt. The camera's valued at $100,000, and it came crashing down around noon yesterday. One vehicle was heavily damaged. Now, you would think a $100,000 camera would be real secure on that helicopter, but apparently it wasn't. But Sergeant Richard Weiner says the camera had been reinstalled on the chopper before it took off, apparently not carefully enough. If you've been in helicopters, you take these tight turns and that type of business. It's kind of fun, but that's a pretty expensive camera. The manufacturer of that must have gotten a good deal when they contracted with the Columbus Police for that sale. But anyway, a $100,000 camera comes flying through the air and lands in your car. I wonder what they've taken pictures of. Well, I guess we can't ask that. Speaking of police in Columbus, Ohio, I found this to be a very interesting story. The police in Columbus are, there are strikes going on all over the place in Columbus, and there are strike breakers who are actually going to work, who are going against the will of the masses, of the people in the organizing unions. And the Columbus police don't want to ride on the streetcars armed. And so they've kind of refused to do that to protect the strikebreakers. April Fool. That's an actual joke that I just looked up in a newspaper article. It's not a joke, but a newspaper article from 1910, August 13, the Columbus police. The Columbus police actually did that. Strikes were going on all over the country there for about a decade, and the cops often refused to side with the strikebreakers. And so they would kind of sit it out, and they would think Chicago was like that, and people started carrying guns, and the Chicago mayor even then said, nobody's going to be carrying guns across their lap then. But isn't that interesting? 1910, August 13th, Columbus police refused to protect people who were going to work. All right, this is the guy that you've been hearing about on the news for quite a while. And he's an escaped inmate. He's been captured by Colorado corrections officials. He's 48-year-old Douglas Elward. He surrendered Wednesday at a home near Yuma, where he had been holding a woman hostage. And this has been on the news off and on. The state corrections director there, Ari Zavaris, said Elward breached a fence around the Sterling Correctional Facility using materials he apparently got from inside the prison. The unidentified materials were found at the fence. This was Elward's fourth escape. Can you believe that? This was his fourth escape. He was serving a 40 to 24 year sentence for attempted murder, assault, burglary, and kidnapping, and he's escaped four times. He would have been eligible for parole in 2 months. I guess he couldn't wait. He had important days or something. But absolutely incredible. And it's been court tested. There are four in the United States electric fences that are deadly fences. And if you touch them at the prison, you're electrocuted. And people say, oh, that's cruel and unusual. But it's been court tested. Because the idea is that you're allowed to use deadly force to stop an escaping prisoner. And therefore, the fence is an example of deadly force. But, I always say nobody will take me up on this. They don't think I'm serious. I am serious. If we would take all these criminals, the ones that get paroled, or even the ones that get probation that don't go to prison, and put a chain on them and a ball and chain weighing about, we vary it by weight, but an 80-pound ball and a chain would pretty much slow them down, wouldn't it? I mean, even the heaviest cops in the world could catch them in a foot chase. So if you're going to be a crime, they could go to picnics, they could go to the county fair and all that, they just have to carry the bowl with them. And it would reduce crime substantially, but everybody thinks I'm crazy. They do all this electronic stuff. We're talking about a simple chain and a ball. It worked, and guess what, folks? It's been used in the past, centuries ago. Okay. Here's what else we can do. Guess what else the United States government is now permitted to do? What can't they do, right? Government agents can now sneak onto your property in the middle of the night, put a GPS device on the bottom of your car, and keep track of you everywhere you go. It doesn't violate your Fourth Amendment rights because you do not have a reasonable expectation of privacy in your driveway. Now, I kind of thought I did. I thought my driveway was mine. You have no reasonable expectation that the government isn't tracking your movements. Isn't that crazy? Now, this is kind of bizarre, as the article says, and it's scary. The rule now applies in California and eight other western states, and the U.S. Circus Court of Appeals, is what I call it, and others, but the Ninth Circuit covers this vast jurisdiction. They ruled in favor of this. And is this George Orwell time, or what is it? Keep in mind that this guy, I won't go through his case, but he was a suspected drug person, and they snuck on his property in the middle of the night and put this GPS tracking device on it, and they tracked him all over the place. Now, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, of course, They're against this, as I am. But in these times, GPS monitoring is a subject that has both conservatives and liberals worried. It's brought people together. And how much can they do? I mean, how close are we to, we may wake up and find we're living in Oceania. If you read Orwell's 1984, you know what I'm talking about. Can you believe that's your own property? They can stick that on there. And, of course, they've been doing all kinds of monitoring and phone stuff. And I'd be very careful about joining the Goggle phone crowd, the system that just started yesterday, because I think a lot of things are going to be listened to. What do you think? Now, listen to this. Police departments in Washington, D.C., they've begun to use technology that can predict when crimes will be committed and who will commit them. Right. Is this kind of like the Minority Report or what? They've begun to use technology. Well, this professor, Richard Burke, at the University of Pennsylvania, says based on previous incarcerations of the software already being used, Baltimore and Philadelphia were limited to predictions of murders by and among parolees and offenders on probation. When a person goes on probation or parole, they are supervised by an officer. The question that officer has to answer is what level of supervision do you provide? Burke told ABC News that imitating that the program could have a bearing on the length of sentences or amounts. The technology assists through a database of thousands of crimes and uses algorithms and different variables such as geographic location, criminal records, and the ages of previous offenders to come up with predictions of where, when, and how a crime could possibly be committed and by who. So can you believe that we have turned over the decision, at least a major portion of it, to some probation and parole cases, to some software predictor? Good luck with that one. That may work about as good as some of our other things have worked in Homeland Security, but just absolutely incredible. The Memphis Police Department, they use a program called Operation Blue Crush, which uses predictive analytics developed by IBM. And they're trying to predict where crimes are going to occur based on this software. And they can tell whether a person has a hostile intent. Oh, my. I can't believe what I'm reading here. Google, the government has plans to collect lifelong records on all residents starting at the age of 5 in order to screen for those who might be more likely to commit crimes in the future. That means you. I know you're older than 5, most of our listeners, but they're going to collect all this information for you. It's going to be legal. And then they're going to predict whether or not Google, it says, and the investment arm of the CIA are investing in this particular product. Isn't that interesting? Google and NQTEL have recently injected a sum of up to $10 million into a company called Recorded Future, which uses analytics to scour Twitter accounts, blogs, and websites for all sorts of information, which is used to assemble actual real-time dossiers on people. And we thought that Ceausescu in Romania was crazy with his 700,000 dossiers, their dictator in the 1960s and 70s and 80s. I mean, I'm going to check this one out. I just can't believe this is going on in the U.S. Okay, we're going to move on here because we got some stuff to do here in just a moment. You remember the full body scanners that came out at the airport? Remember none of the pictures were going to be stored? They showed, they revealed virtually everything. Well, guess what now? They now have full body scan technology deployed in roving street vans. I'm not kidding. As the privacy controversy around full body scans continues, it's worth noting that courthouses and airport security checkpoints aren't the only places where backscatter X-ray vision is being deployed. It's being deployed on the streets of the United States, seeing through people's clothes and the walls and into their vehicles. So that van that you go by, maybe you attractive women out walking or something, you notice that van keeps circling. They're scanning. This 500 backscatter X-ray scanners mounted in vans that can be driven past neighboring vehicles to see their contents. They have a little picture on this news article on top of it that shows, they actually show the person sitting in the car, and it does go through the clothes. And again, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, fine organization, is currently suing the Department of Homeland Security over these airport deployments of backscatter scanners, which can reveal detailed images of human bodies. Remember when Big Sis, Janet Napolitano, the head of Homeland Security, said that they weren't storing any of those images? Guess what? They found out they were storing some of the images, and then we had even the case of the guy was told somebody, they made jokes about his genitalia because they had actually had a full body scan picture of him. But can you believe it? These vans, so when you see that van going around the block a couple times, or stop and turn around and come back to look at you, be careful. They may be looking at more than, your running shoes. Okay, interesting stuff. Predictive software, and one more here I want to look at, but I think we'll skip that one. Replacing textbooks with an iPad, that's not it. We already talked last week, about Cleveland is now putting RFID chips in trash cans to see if you recycle. What's 1984, I guess the new book would be called 2010, 20 times 10, in terms of surveillance. But, folks, we need to support organizations like the EPIC and resisting this kind of thing. I mean, whatever happened to privacy, it's a right. It's the most important one. Okay, what we're going to do now is take a listen to some testimony at a Heritage Conference, not testimony, presentations, at a Heritage Conference, Foundation Conference, on the role of the private sector in Homeland Security. And I think what you're going to find out, remember thinking of Top Secret America, remember there are 1,200 public organizations and 1,900 private organizations in the United States working on counterterrorism, intelligence, and homeland security. That's a total of 3,100 if you're adding things up. And these people are going to be talking about critical infrastructure protection. Mike, you can't say that bad yet, Kenny, but critical infrastructure protection, on protecting our infrastructure. And I always worry about my infrastructure. So listen to this, and I think you'll enjoy it if you can kind of put up with it. Because it is in such generalized terms, it either means everything or nothing in terms of these presenters, and these people are supposed to be experts. It seems like in any type of technical presentation, you ought to define your terms. They never do. But here we go. Give me a second here to set this up. It disappeared. I'll get it back. Hold on. It's a two-computer night, but we're only using one. Hold on. Close. We should have background music. I know. We found it. They buried it. I apologize. We're set here.
The sector companies play in homeland security efforts. The Heritage Foundation is hosting this week-long conference on threats to U.S. national security. This is 2 hours.
Listen to the
Good morning. Welcome to the Heritage Foundation. As Director of Lectures and Seminars, it's my privilege to welcome you to our Lewis Lehrman Auditorium and, of course, to welcome those who join us on our heritage.org website and who are also joining us today via C-SPAN. We would ask everyone else in house to make sure your cell phones have been turned off as a courtesy to our presenters, and we will post the program within 24 hours on the Heritage website for everyone's future reference. Hosting our discussion this morning is Jenna Baker McNeil. Jenna also put together our 5-day symposium for this week, so we do appreciate her work in that as well. Jenna serves as policy analyst for Homeland Security and our Douglas and Sarah Allison Center for Foreign Policy Studies. Before joining Heritage, she was a research assistant for the Hutchison Group, LLC, and she previously worked as an environmental management consultant for Booz Allen Hamilton, as well as a staff assistant for Maryland Governor Robert Early. Please join me in welcoming my colleague, Jenna Baker McNeil. Jenna?
Well, good morning and welcome to day 3 of Homeland Security 2020, the future of defending the homeland. And, you know, today we're really going to talk about working with the private sector. I think we've learned from the attacks of 9/11, Hurricane Katrina, and other catastrophic disasters of the importance and a vital role that the private sector can play, but also the need to have strong relationships with the private sector. You know, there's a statistic often floated around is that 85% of critical infrastructure is owned by the private sector, and that's very, very true. It's how much of it really is, you know, in that domain. So it becomes very important that our critical infrastructure protection efforts not only stop, you know, and help prevent acts of terrorism, but also to keep the economy going strong. And I think we have two panelists today that are really going to give us their idea of what the future of critical infrastructure should look like. And they're really distinguished people. Let me introduce them to you. One of them is Jessica Herrera Flanagan. She right now is at Monument Policy Group, but she previously served as the staff director and general counsel for the House Committee on Homeland Security. She was also the principal staff liaison for the committee with congressional leadership and the administration. Jessica has also served as a senior counsel at the Computer Crime and Intelligence Property Section, Criminal Division of the U.S. Department of Justice, where she focused on technology issues and led the section's cybercrime investigation team. Cybersecurity is such an issue. You could have a whole section on that, which we will later this week. So Jessica really, before her government service, worked at Crowell and Morning LLP in Washington, where she practiced communications, media, intellectual property, and energy law. She has taught as an adjunct professor at the Washington College of Law at American University and at the American Military University. She is currently a senior fellow at the George Washington University Homeland Security Policy Institute. In addition, I think this is a great statistic. Jessica is active in the Hispanic community, and she's been named 3 times by Hispanic Business Magazine as one of the 100 most influential Hispanics in the United States. She received her JD from the Harvard Law School and her BA with distinction in American Studies from Yale University. Please join me in welcoming Jessica Herrera Flanagan.
I think I'll start out, and as we talk about the future of critical infrastructure protection, it's important to discuss how did we get to where we are today? Now, what is the path?
She's had a lot of practice. Notice how fast she can say it. Critical infrastructure protection.
Predates that several years, if not decades. First big federal government initiative, I think, in critical infrastructure protection, when we started hearing that phrase, came in 1996. It was after the Oklahoma City bombing. There was the creation of a critical infrastructure working group to look at how do we better protect ourselves? What do we need to be doing? From that working group, President Clinton created a commission on critical infrastructure protection, also known as the Marsh Commission, to look at the issues and come up with a report and recommendations on what do we need to be doing? How do we engage the private sector? What should be out there? In 97, that commission actually issued its report, and interestingly, it took a very different take. Even though it came out of Oklahoma, the Oklahoma City bombing, it actually focused more on cybersecurity. So getting into where does cybersecurity and critical infrastructure end and begin, it's become a big issue. And we saw that with the creation of the department, which I'll talk about in a minute. But that was a question on how should we be focusing on critical infrastructure. Do we talk about physical? Do we talk about cyber? I know there's a session tomorrow on cyber, but what does it mean? From that commission's recommendation came PDD 63, Presidential Directive 63, which looked at critical infrastructure protection in the federal government. What do we need to have in terms of private sector partnerships? It created several entities within the federal government, the National Infrastructure Protection Center, the Critical Infrastructure Assurance Office, and a few others that had all kinds of interesting little names. You had NIPSI, CHOW, and a couple others that popped up. We love to have acronyms in the federal government. And interestingly, those all took a cybersecurity focus. There was less emphasis, again, on physical. Those eventually became part of the Department of Homeland Security, mostly. Some sections did not go over from their original agencies, but they are all now part of the National Cybersecurity Division or got merged into that. So there was less of a focus on physical. So I guess one of the first questions we have to ask ourselves when we look at sort of the history and all moving forward is how do we differentiate between the cybersecurity area and the physical area? Why do we distinguish? Do we distinguish? Originally, when the Department of Homeland Security was put together, there wasn't necessarily that differentiation between the two. They were merged together. Congress, and I have to say I was part of this effort, thought, well, we should distinguish between them. The areas we need to be looking at on the physical side are very different than the areas we need to be looking at on the cybersecurity side. The expertise needed to secure a chemical security plant is different than the expertise you'd need to secure an IT facility. So there's that. But at the same time, cybersecurity is integrated into all the physical elements, the chemical security plants, the energy grid, smart grid, all these things all have cyber elements. And I think that's where the struggle has come over the years, and even going back to the mid-1990s, is how do you take something that is integrated into the physical and separate it out while still addressing the physical challenges? And I think as we look forward, that's going to be something that we have to tackle. One of the big challenges, which I'll talk about a little bit more when we talk about the different agencies that have been tasked with critical infrastructure protection, is you have agencies who have responsibilities over the physical side of things. What's happened over time is you've had the department was created under the Homeland Security Act. You've had HSPD 7, which laid out sector-specific agencies that were responsible for different areas. So the Department of Energy has certain areas that it's responsible for. Transportation has the transportation sector, just because those are the entities and the agencies that have specific responsibilities and relationships with the relevant private sector entities. Who better to deal with the transportation sector than the Department of Transportation, which deals with them on a daily basis? I think with a lot of the reasoning behind that. Now, the problem becomes, however, is while these agencies may deal with various types of sectors, security is not necessarily first and foremost. They're dealing with transportation entities on a wide variety of things. So how do you make that transfer over to have an agency that's not responsible, per se, for security, make security a viable function? And when we talk about security, we're really talking about resiliency protection efforts. That's not a priority necessarily for a lot of the different agencies. They have a lot of priorities. It's one of many. And how do you transfer that over? And I think that's been a struggle as we look at the critical infrastructure space. What do you do about that? And
the glossary of expert terms is coming later.
So one of the questions now is there are 18 sector-specific sectors out there. There's been a lot of work done on all of them. Nine of them have been made public so that you can actually see what's happening. The other nine, not so public just because of sensitivities. And we need to look to the future again, look at the agencies, see what their priorities are. The priorities aren't in the budget. I should have mentioned that as well. If you look at budgets, budgets, there are securities not high in a lot of agencies' budgets that have specific sectors that they're looking at. The Department of Homeland Security obviously has a coordinating role that's evolved over time, but how much authority does it have over sectors when it doesn't deal with it daily? And we're going to have to look at how we deal with that and what do we need to be doing going forward. Should the department take a larger role with all the sectors?
No.
Should we just leave it to the various agencies to deal with? How do you get two agencies to work together? Well, one has a specific mission and others don't as they work for different sectors. And what does that mean for the private sector? I mean, if you're a company in the private sector and you have to deal with two different agencies and have these added thoughts and added responsibilities and dealing with them, that's a struggle. And I think that's something that we're watching closely. I think the other thing that we'll see going forward is if you go back even to the 90s, we looked at critical infrastructure protection as a national issue. Oklahoma City bombing, this is a national issue. We're going to take a national approach, a federal government approach to dealing with critical infrastructure protection. What we've seen evolve over time, though, is it's not that simple. It's sector-specific, so now we have all these different sectors, but it's also regionally specific. Industries have certain responsibilities and certain... It may not be across the board. So when you deal with an owner and operator of a chemical facility in the Gulf of Mexico, it's going to be very different than if you're dealing with the same types of owners and operators off the coast or internal to the United States somewhere. So I think as we go forward, we are going to look to see more of a regionalized model on critical infrastructure protection. So it'll be sector-specific and regionalized. The good thing about taking a regionalized model, or we should at least, is that you're more likely to pick up some of the smaller businesses and middle-sized businesses. That's one of the things that's really been missing on the critical infrastructure protection front. When you're looking at it on a nationalized level, you're looking at it on the federal government level, you get the big companies dealing with specific sectors. But you're not going to necessarily pick up the little guys who are out in whatever city, town you want to talk about, because they're not going to have the resources to come and attend meetings here in D.C. and spend a lot of money to join ISACs or sector coordinating councils. So a regionalized approach would allow a lot more of those companies to become involved and take an active role in protecting critical infrastructure. I think the other thing we're going to see and really think about or need to be thinking about is what do you do about risk? We haven't...
I just want to add to help explain what she's trying to say is, you know, we have to worry about your local shoe store and the Dairy Queen, and they have critical infrastructure protection concerns also.
A lot of times we take a more reactionary role. We don't look at the risk. We look at what's happened, and let's just react, and that has an adverse effect, I think, on the private sector. So going forward, how to build more risk programs and risk management issues into critical infrastructure protection is going to be critical. I think, and I'll end on this, so we can keep things moving, is the biggest question for the federal government is how do we move from emphasizing protection, which I think we've done, to more of a resiliency model. That is, we focused on deterring threats, mitigating vulnerabilities, minimizing consequences once disasters and attacks happen, sort of the reactionary approach. And what do we do to move more to a resiliency approach? That is, how do we resist, absorb, successfully adapt, respond to, and recover from disasters and attacks? How do we become more flexible so that when something like what's happened with BP in the Gulf of Mexico occurs, we're able to respond more quickly so we're not...
I suspect your answer is to spend billions of more dollars and employ more private security companies.
And I think that is going to be the biggest theme and issue that going forward as we look at critical infrastructure protection and how we're going to merge the private sector, the various agencies, and the various state and local entities as well into it. I didn't even touch upon that. I'm mostly focusing on the private sector, but that's something to consider as well. With that, I'll stop there.
All right. I'm going to introduce you to Alan Windsor, who is a former advisor at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and consultant on Homeland Security strategic planning and policy issues. For the last 2 years, Mr. Windsor has been working with private and public sector clients in the Emirate of Abu Dhabi, UAE, where he led a project to develop the Emirate's first comprehensive maritime security strategy, integrating security with transportation, coastal management, and infrastructure protection efforts. Prior to his work in Abu Dhabi, Mr. Windsor served in the U.S. Department of Homeland Security as a policy advisor in both the Office of the Deputy Secretary and the Policy Directorate. As a coordinator for the DHS Work Group on Countering Violent Domestic Extremism, he worked closely with U.S. agencies and international partners to integrate counterterrorism approaches and policies. Mr. Windsor has also worked on domestic counterterrorism issues for the Homeland Security Institute. He earned his B.S. from James Madison University and holds a Master's of Public Administration from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please join me in welcoming Alan Windsor.
Thank you very much, and I really appreciate the opportunity to come in and be a part of this today. I think this is an exciting opportunity, an exciting week of panels to look at emerging issues over the next 10 years, to look at Homeland Security 2020 and what are the major challenges out there and the trends in particular issues. I think that the private sector subject is particularly interesting because I think that there is an increasing need to find nodes for the private sector to plug in to the critical infrastructure protection domain and the Homeland Security field in a wider sense. As Jim said, for the last 2 years, I've worked as a consultant in the Emirate of Abu Dhabi, where I've advised public and private sector clients on critical infrastructure strategy and policy issues, really working with a lot of clients to not only develop the risk assessments that we're going to look at their critical infrastructure areas, but also formulate the policies and strategies that would address those concerns. And it was really a lot of fun to work with clients in an emerging economy, because in many ways the slate is completely blank. As they build new airports, seaports, water and sewer systems, IT infrastructure, they not only have the opportunity to build security into the system from the design phase of a particular project, they also have the opportunity to shape policies, regulations, and procedures in an environment that's relatively new. Obviously, Abu Dhabi is a fundamentally different operating environment than the United States, as opposed to the U.S., where the magical number, 85% of the nation's critical infrastructure is owned and operated by the private sector. Most of the major industries in the Emirate, oil and gas, telecommunications, and others, are government owned, at least majority owned. And my team thought that would be the biggest advantage that we had going in and helping the Emiratis build their system of maritime and critical infrastructure protection. The reality turned out to be fairly different. Industry players in the UAE were just as concerned about maintaining a proper balance between security and efficiency as their U.S. industrial counterparts. And it turned out in the end that the Emiratis shared a number of very similar concerns as the ones we face here in the United States: how to share actionable and timely information between government and private sector partners, how to effectively screen workers working in critical industries, and how to properly assess threats and develop an acceptable appetite for risk in particular industries, and many other issues. One of the things I noticed over and over was their desire for best practices from the United States. It's something I also noticed in my discussions with people in places like India. Even as these emerging economies build some of the most sophisticated critical infrastructure, just infrastructure systems in the world, they're looking to the United States for leadership in the field of critical infrastructure protection, emergency management, and some other areas. And in a world that's increasingly interconnected, we have to take that kind of leadership in this field very seriously.
I wonder who they're passing those ideas we're giving away to.
Foreign trade for critical assets. The security of foreign critical infrastructure will be increasingly important. And one of the best ways we can ensure the security of that foreign infrastructure is to develop the kinds of best practices here in the United States that others want to adapt to their own systems. So that's what I'd like to briefly talk a little bit about today, is two areas that I think will not only be vital to improving our own infrastructure protection in the U.S., but will also ensure our continued leadership on the issue around the world. The first concept I'd really like to talk to you, and we talked a little bit about it, is the concept of resiliency. It's a concept that's really caught on around the world, not only in the area of critical infrastructure protection, but other various areas. I remember when I was at DHS, and you know, we were pushing this concept in its initial stage. There was some initial pushback, and people really saw resilience as another word for redundancy. And I think that, unfortunately, the understanding of the concept has matured over time, as most people are beginning to think of vulnerabilities and criticalities in terms of a systems approach to risk management. But I still think that there's a next evolution of the concept. When we talk about resiliency, most folks are still focused on the ability of a particular system to operate or rebound after an event. And as we look into the next 10 years to 2020, I think the concept will inevitably broaden quite a bit to focus on the ability of an economy to operate or rebound after an event. And the only way you can really identify assets and nodes critical to a resilient economy is to really systematically assess threats and risks and develop policies and regulations that appropriately address those risks. Risk assessment, I should say, has come a long way in the last couple of years. The National Infrastructure Protection Plan, the NIP, is a great example, with the use of consistent methodologies for assessing risks increasingly. You know, risk management should be our number one tool for prioritizing assets for protection in an age of increasingly scarce homeland security dollars. I'm glad to see that we're moving in the direction of comparing apples to apples when it comes to allocating resources. I'm not advocating some sort of nationwide economic assessment to guide homeland security dollars. I think the QHSR gets to that issue to a slight extent. When we're talking about the next evolution of resiliency, I think the bulk of the work may be done at the regional and local level. State and local governments are really best positioned to determine which elements of local economies are most critical. And they're also best positioned to work with private sector actors to develop solutions to the protection of critical assets. You may have a locality that is particularly dependent on the tourism and business trade, for example, a locality that prioritizes hotel security as a high priority. Those localities can work with developers to institute design standards through local planning authorities to deter or mitigate incidents at those particular types of facilities. You may have another locality that may want to focus on iconic structures or particular nodes in the local transportation systems. In any case, local and private sector actors are going to be best positioned to assess vulnerabilities and particular economic consequences. And federal authorities should be in a localities with threat information to guide risk assessments and resource allocation. Now, none of this is to say that we shouldn't continue to focus on protection and resiliency of critical assets nationwide. Far from it. We need to continue to ensure that
I had to stop that. I'm sorry. I just can't take it anymore. I assume that all of our 21,000 listeners or whatever it is who listen all speak English, at least English, and many speak other languages, I'm sure. But may I ask the question, do you have any idea what these two people are talking about had you not been inside this field or at least studied it a little bit? I mean, the jargon is off the page, isn't it? They never drop down to the life or the level of where we live. I did hear them talk about hotel and motel. My God, we're not going to have the federal government involved in protecting our hotels and motels. Are we? My Lord, I can't believe it. But do you have any idea what they're talking about? I don't. Read Top Secret America and listen to this yourself. Go to cspan.org and listen to the show called "The Role of the Private Sector in Homeland Security." It was just August 25th, few days ago, 2010. In fact, that was yesterday when this presentation was made, and. I've asked Audrey if she can. She's listened and she speaks very well. Of course, she's a famous, a reader and broadcast and that type of thing. And I've asked Audrey if she can, pronounce this word or this term, this phrase, critical infrastructure protection. Let's see how you do, Audrey.
Critical Infrastructure Protection Plan.
Mike, can you do it? Let's hear it.
Critical Infrastructure Protection Plan.
Pretty good, Mike. You could work for Homeland Security with that. All right, we're going to do it. Try Emily. I'm sure she could probably do it. Emily doesn't want to do it. She won't. Oh, yeah, okay, go ahead. Go ahead. Don't be timid. Emily? Well, apparently Emily doesn't want to do it. So what we're going to do is go ahead and sign off. And ladies and gentlemen, if you have the time, I would ask you to listen to an hour of that show and listen to what these people are talking about. And remember, lying at the foundation of all this conversation are literally billions of dollars of your and my tax dollars that they're spending on things that we don't even understand what they're talking about. Am I off somewhere, Mike? Let me know. We'll see you next week, folks.
Again, don't know where, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.